Good morning. Welcome to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. My name is Peter Gosline, and I am the moderator for this morning's program. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is held at the historic Unitarian Universalist Church in downtown Peterborough, New Hampshire, at 11 o'clock on summer Sunday mornings. We invite our New Hampshire Public Radio audience to attend these programs and to meet our speakers at the reception following the program. Again, our speaker today is Dr. Martin McCary, and he will be talking to us about the future of healthcare. Martin McCary is an accomplished physician, New York Times best-selling author, and television medical commentator. He has also written articles for the Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, and CNN, among others. Dr. McCary was born in Liverpool, England, moved to Baltimore early on, and later to Danville, Pennsylvania. He attended Bucknell University and later attended Thomas Jefferson University and Harvard University. At Harvard, he obtained an MPH, a Master of Public Health degree, with a concentration in health policy. Dr. McCary completed a 5-year surgical residency program at Georgetown University. He did subspecialty training at Johns Hopkins and later joined a faculty practice there as partner and professor. He practices advanced laparoscopic surgery at the Johns Hopkins Hospital and teaches health policy at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. McCary is known as an international expert in patient safety and has served in leadership roles with the International Union of Risk Management and at the United Nations World Health Organization. He is an outspoken advocate for transparency in medicine and common sense solutions to healthcare's problems, such as the surgical checklist, which he developed at Johns Hopkins and which was popularized in Atul Gawande's best-selling book, Checklist Manifesto. Among other books, Dr. McCary is the author of the New York Times best-selling book, Unaccountable, in which he proposes common sense solutions to fix the healthcare system by actively promoting transparency of healthcare process and outcome measures and empowering patients with information to choose where to go for their medical care. Dr. McCary has been the recipient of numerous awards for research and teaching and has been a visiting professor and lecturer at a number of U.S. locations. He is a regular commentator on CNN. We are indeed fortunate to have with us today someone who has accomplished so much and someone who is able to inspire others with such a clear and important message. I know we are in store for an informative, challenging, and inspiring presentation by Dr. McCary today. I'd like to introduce Dr. Martin McCary.
Well, thank you, Peter, and thank all of you for coming. I'm really flattered, and the first time I remember speaking, there were only two people in the audience, and I got up to the podium, and I was thrown off. I was a new faculty member, and my excitement quickly deflated when I looked at this giant auditorium, and I saw only two people. So I said, I didn't know what to say. I just said, I want to thank both of you for coming. And they looked back at me and said, we're just here because we're giving the next two talks. You know, if you come down to Johns Hopkins and walk in the lobby on a Thursday morning when the medical students are interviewing for medical school, you will meet some of the most extraordinary people in the world. These are the cream of the crop of America's universities. And they are entering a career because they have a deep passion to take care of patients, to fight disease, and to be involved in public health. It's truly remarkable. They're dressed up in suits that many of them bought the night before. They are dressed to the nine. They're smiling, they're happy, they have that youthful enthusiasm. They're visionaries. When asked in their interview what would you like to do when you become a doctor? Or the question, why do you want to become a doctor? Here are the answers we hear. I want to do some form of medical missions. I want to serve the poor. I want to go overseas. 99% of our applicants want to serve the poor or do some form of charitable missions type work as a part of their medical practice, if not full-time, part-time. It's a truly extraordinary group of people. But then they matriculate. They go through 2 years of classes, 2 years of work in the hospital, a stressful period where they're being evaluated constantly. I mean, they're so nervous in their third year. They sort of apprentice us for part of the time in the third year. And, it's funny that sometimes I'll have a medical student follow me into the bathroom because they're so nervous. Then they go to residency. And after 4 years of difficult school with stressful exams, they start a process where they're getting paid a very low salary. I was paid $29,000 a year my first year. And all of a sudden, it's time to look for fellowship opportunities at the end of 5 years of training. And you look for another 1 to 2 years of subspecialty training. You come out almost 10 years older, an entirely different person. When asked what percent of doctors will respond to perverse financial incentives, doctors say that it's over 20%. When asked the question, are doctors more likely to perform an unnecessary test or procedure if they directly profit from it? The answer in the general public is 52%. But among doctors, the answer is 73%. It's almost as if doctors know their own kind very well. What happened? We took some of the most extraordinary people at the beginning of this process, and we have a system that is contaminated with the problems of overtreatment, medical mistakes, and response to perverse incentives. Everybody agrees now we have tremendous waste in healthcare. Well, if you look at any corporation, any community, when people see their job as just being one small sliver of the pie, then things fall apart. When we have nurses that say, well, I could tell something was wrong, but it wasn't my job to speak up, things are falling apart. When you have a corporation where the people on the front lines of the corporation say, things here are just not running properly, but we didn't feel comfortable speaking up because that's not our job, things fall apart, that corporation's about to go bankrupt. When you have someone at an automotive plant say that the part that they're assembling is being assembled onto a faulty part that's put on before their point in the assembly line, but they don't speak up because they only see their role as that of the specific job they have, things are about to fall apart. There's something about the parks in New England. I remember watching somebody in the Boston Common notice a piece of trash, walk over. They didn't look around to see if anybody was noticing, and they picked up that piece of trash and threw it in the trash can. It wasn't their piece of trash. It wasn't their fault. But they had a sense of pride in the product. Culture, I would submit to you, is the defining aspect of any institution, community, or hospital. And it's probably the area where we can find the answers to fixing America's healthcare problems. I've been to hospitals where it doesn't matter what your job is. If you're concerned about a patient, you speak up. I've seen hospitals where nurses will say, I saw something that didn't look right, and they address it with the doctor, or vice versa. The doctor addresses it with the nurse. People speak up when they sense that something isn't right because they're concerned about the final product of their services. I'm taking a class now at the Apple store. I'm turned into an Apple guy, and I've got an Apple laptop. And when I walk into the store for this video editing class that I'm taking, the instructor, professor, or teacher, I'm not sure what you call him, I think he's 11 years old. He is very excited that I'm there. Matter of fact, when I walk to the back of the store, as I walk in, everybody in the store is eager to answer my questions. I was so blown away by the service that I finally asked my instructor, professor, or whatever you call him, I said, look, are you guys paid on a commission basis? I mean, they're, you know, trying to ask me how they can help when I walk in the store. Maybe you need this, and why don't you open your computer now, and I'll take a look at it. I said, are you paid on a commission basis? He says, what are you talking about? I said, do you get a cut? Do you get a commission? Do you get paid based on what gets sold? He says, no, we love working here. There's a corporate culture at Apple. You know, they say that people never dispose their old Apple computers. And I thought of that. I thought, you know, I've got a couple Apple computers still laying around. It's almost as if you have a sense of attraction that it's a part of you. Well, I'll say this publicly because it's now all in the public after Steve Jobs' book has been published, but we got to know Steve Jobs at Johns Hopkins. He came there for an opinion. He had a pancreas tumor, as you may know, and my group is a group that specializes in pancreas surgery. Hopefully I'll never see any of you in that context, although I would love to see all of you again, but not in the context. All my patients leave and say, thank you, but I hope I never see you again. Well, Steve Jobs invited one of my colleagues to come visit him in California. And my colleague loves Apple. He's the one that got me into Apple Computer. And when Steve Jobs said, would you like to come out and meet some of the board at Apple Computer and maybe have lunch with me and you can meet me at my house and we'll head over together, my friend was like, ah, what? Well, he went out to California. He put in the address into his GPS, and he drove to a home, and he looked out at this house after the GPS said, you have arrived. And he looked at this house, and he said, oh my God, I must have put in the wrong town. It's a small house with no street, no garages, only street parking, and it's a very modest community. I'm going to be late. And he thought, what the heck, I'm just going to ask this person. Maybe somebody else has made this mistake before. And he knocks on the door. The door opens, and there appears Steve Jobs. And my friend says, what's with the house? And Steve Jobs says, ah, the kids like it. And they went to the Apple headquarters, and my friend noticed that they have one cafeteria for the entire company. Steve Jobs wanted it that way. And he eats in that cafeteria at these common tables that he designed in classic Steve Jobs fashion. And they sit together and they meet people at the company they've never met before and hear what they're working on and hear about what they're doing. It's a community, just as you know each other's lives here in this community. It creates an enormous sense of local culture. Hospitals have done that. Other hospitals have not done that. Other hospitals have gotten into trouble for the same mistakes that corporations have made and gotten into trouble. If you look at some of these giant corporations that have fallen, be it Enron or any other corporation, there's an intense sense of nobody really owns the product. Everybody's out for themselves. Now, we can learn a lot from industry in healthcare. As a matter of fact, it's something we saw on the financial crisis. The CEO of Lehman Brothers, Richard Fold. Now, if you remember, Lehman Brothers was the one bank that was considered in such bad shape, even the government decided not to bail it out during the financial bailout. Now, what was it about Lehman Brothers in particular? When asked, insiders said that the reason Lehman Brothers was not bailed out was because of the bad corporate culture. You see, Richard Fold, the CEO, was known to call in ahead of time. He had his elevator programmed so the limo driver would call ahead and have the elevator held in the lobby. Security guard would clear the lobby. He would get out of the limo, go to the into the elevator that went right to, directly to his executive suite. He would only interact with members of his executive team. He was never seen on the trading floor. In the words of one of his own vice presidents of the bank, Mr. Fuld went out of his way to make sure he never interacted with a single employee at Lehman Brothers. That is a culture problem. Now, so we've seen good and bad culture modeled in industry. We've seen it in medicine. How do we change this variation? If there's one problem in healthcare today, it's the variation in quality. We have research and quality that is the envy of the world. I've got some folks back at the hospital right now that have come in from far away. They're wealthy. They're part of a royal family. They have come all the way to the United States to get medical care because they know that we offer some of the highest quality medical care in the world. But we also offer some of the worst medical care in the world. We've got wide variations as they do everywhere. How do we rein in these wide variations? I believe the simple answer is transparency. If performance at a hospital level could be something that wasn't just the subject of backroom conversations or country club poker games, if it were instead something that was objective, hospitals could be proud of their good performance and people would talk about it. If you knew that there was a hospital that had a 40% C-section rate, you would probably avoid that, knowing that the national average is 7%. Yet in my own city where I live, one of the hospitals has a 40% C-section rate. Simple transparency goes a long way. Now, we've got to have good ways of measuring healthcare if we're going to make it transparent. Otherwise, we're going to punish the doctors and hospitals that do the good job of taking care of the high-risk populations or the populations that no one else would take care of, and we'll reward those that discriminate against them. The metrics have got to be good. They've got to be risk-adjusted. And for the first time, we're seeing a revolution in medicine where they are measuring quality in a productive, meaningful way. And it's a work in progress. You know, I had a patient where I made a mistake. I've made many mistakes in my life, and I've made mistakes as a doctor. I made this mistake ordering a test on a patient that had a similar name to another patient. Well, it was a CAT scan, and I went to the office, and someone came up to me and said, you know, the CAT scan was done on the wrong patient. I felt terrible, and I immediately left what I was doing, and I went to that patient that was supposed to have the CAT scan, and I wanted to explain what happened, and I thought, geez, this patient is going to sue me. I already had a strained relationship with this patient. This patient came in with a certain expectation of their recovery. They had an infection afterwards. It was a strained relationship. And I went to that patient and I said, yeah, you were supposed to get a CAT scan today. It was not done. It was a mistake. It was my fault. I'm going to make sure that this CAT scan gets done today. And as soon as it gets done, I'll come and share the results with you. I went to the other patient that got the CAT scan and I said, you had an unnecessary test today because of a mistake I made. I'm happy to share the results with you, but I'm sorry. Well, both patients, including the one with the strained relationship, looked at me and said, you know, doctor, thank you for coming here and just explaining that to me. I really appreciate it. Our relationship from that point got better. And I thought, you know, people are okay with the imperfections of modern medicine, but they are hungry for transparency. People are starving for simple honesty in healthcare. And I thought, what are the implications for our performance and all the work we're doing on national transparency? I am convinced people are hungry for simple honesty in healthcare. Some people find the medical system to be a black box. People have had bad experiences. Everyone knows of somebody that's been harmed in some way from something that maybe shouldn't have happened. Some people find my profession to be a closed-door culture, one which doesn't fully explain everything or do a good job explaining things. These are things we can improve upon. These are things that the young generation of doctors are having no tolerance for, and they're doing a better job. We're seeing a transparency revolution in healthcare. And as an observer and a believer in this movement, I felt compelled to write the book, Unaccountable. I felt a little bit like a journalist describing the efforts of the shared decision-making movement, the Open Notes campaign. You know, I had a patient where I was taking notes as they were explaining their abdominal pain to me, and this patient asked some questions that some may think were a little bit crazy. She asked, can this pain be related to the new Ben & Jerry's flavor that they started eating? They asked if it could be from yoga. They asked if it could be some stress that they had in their life a year ago. I said, no, it's unrelated. Well, I noticed after the patient asked those questions, they had a little more distance and were maybe a little more suspicious of me. Their tone of voice changed, and at the end of the interview, I said, is everything okay? She said, yeah, and I said, is there anything that's bothering you? And she said, well, what did you write about me? And I said, well, I just took some notes here. Let's read it together. This is what I'm going to put in your chart. Are you okay with this? And, you know, of course, she adjusted her age. I'm not really 52. I'm 51. And, you know, but she said, you know, I was worried you were going to write the thing about the ice cream. And I thought, you know, people are starving for honesty. Maybe I should just share all the notes with every patient. And I started offering patients a note, and I would dictate on the phone and say, I'm going to put a little note in your chart. I'm going to dictate it. If you hear anything that's not right, please just chime in. And sure enough, I'll say, you know, the patient had a hysterectomy in 1984, and they'll say, no, it was 85. And now we have this conversation together. It's totally transparent. The patients love it. The patients love it. Now I find out there's a national movement to make notes totally transparent to patients. You know, if you come to our hospital, we do very well, but we've got problems. And I think the more honest we can be about our problems, the more we can work to fix these problems in the United States. I'm talking about the problems of preventable harm, infections, errors. How common do you think these problems are in the United States? Well, I don't want to scare you because I've got patients that are hesitant to have a valve replacement, even though they desperately need it, and it will make them better, and it's a safe procedure, but they're suspicious. Most of what we do in healthcare is very safe, but if you look at the sheer numbers of medical mistakes and preventable infections together are the number three cause of death in the United States, using the CDC statistics. I was just in Egypt 3-4 weeks ago. Actually, today is a very interesting day in the time of the history of Egypt. They're going to have massive protests today at the one-year anniversary of the election of the most recent president, who's not very popular. And the people are angry, and they're planning massive demonstrations today. So check out the news. I'm not sure which news is going to be interested in this, given the Zimmerman trial that's going on and the international manhunt for Mr. Snowden. But there may be a revolution in the Middle East, and one of the greatest countries in the Middle East and one of our closest allies. I was over there and I realized, you know, the problems of public health in Africa have left out one major problem. All the efforts have focused on malaria, HIV, infectious diseases, tropical medicine, but they've left out one thing, the problem of quality. The quality problem kills more people than tuberculosis, HIV, and malaria combined. I heard stories of surgeons that did operations where all they would do is cut the skin on someone's chest and then sew it right back up and tell the family the patient had a successful heart operation. I heard stories of a cornea being removed without consent. I heard stories of unnecessary surgery rampant because, unlike doctors here, the doctors there are in financial trouble. Sometimes they can't even make ends meet. I've seen doctors in Africa take the bus to work because they can't afford a car. We need to start being honest about the problem of wide variations in quality, not only so we can address it here, but we can also address what, in my opinion, is perhaps the number one public health problem in the world today, and also the number one problem that has received zero attention, the problem of quality. What can be done about quality? Well, I wrote an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association a few weeks ago about using accountability in medicine. I'm not talking about having a government regulator come in and watch the surgery that I'm doing. I'm talking about maybe let's hit the record button on the video-based procedures that we do and give the patients a copy. put it in their electronic record. There was a doctor about 7 miles from the hospital in which I work, a cardiologist who was at Johns Hopkins Hospital in the past. He allegedly put in over 500 unnecessary heart stents and was fired from the hospital. What if they had recorded those procedures? What if the patients had a copy? What if somebody would have gotten a second opinion? Somebody would have blown the whistle and said, hey, wait a minute, this blood vessel was never blocked. It would have added some accountability. What if we had external peer review in medicine? These are simple steps. These are not new ideas. These are ideas that have been put forth over 100 years ago. You know, Dr. Doug Rex is probably the most famous GI doctor in the country. He's at Indiana University. Now, a little background. When I was in medical school, I watched colonoscopy being done. I know it's not a pleasant thought, especially, you know, on a Sunday morning, the idea of having a screening colonoscopy when you turn 50 every 3 to 5 years. But this is the guy who put it on the map. He is the father of colonoscopy, if you will. I remember watching colonoscopy as a medical student, and there was a polyp discovered. I thought, what are we going to do about this? Is this patient going to need surgery? And the gastroenterologist said, no, there's a way to remove these using a snare through the colonoscope. And I'm not good at it, but go over and grab the doctor next door. He's very good. And I went over and got him, and he came in and with a metal snare in about 2 minutes removed this polyp. The patient woke up and was told, we discovered a polyp. It was removed. There's nothing to do. You can get another colonoscopy in a year just to check. But it was a great moment where I could witness the marvels of modern medicine to extend life. The next day, with another doctor, I was learning colonoscopy, and we discovered a polyp that was identical. It was almost as if it was the same patient. And I said, this was at a good hospital, mind you. I said, are you going to remove this endoscopically? And he said, no, I just like to take these out with surgery. And I said, well, yesterday I saw somebody come in, and I went over and got this doctor, and he came in and removed it with the snare, and you know, I think it's amenable. And they said, look, I just like to take these out with surgery. And the patient woke up and was told, you need to have a major operation. The patient had an open colon removal. I didn't know whether or not it was my lack of knowledge in medicine, or you know, this was maybe good judgment, or if this was just a massive disparity in quality. And sure enough, the patient had the surgery, had a complication. I felt terrible. I talked to some other doctors, and now knowing what I know as a GI surgeon, that was wrong. Why is it that you have these massive disparities in quality, even at good hospitals, with very little transparency? Well, this is the problem that hospital administrators and doctors are now getting serious about. They're saying, we want to address quality. I think this is an exciting time in healthcare. You know, this is really the fundamental issue of our system. I got so frustrated listening to the politicians during the healthcare reform debates talk about different ways to finance the broken healthcare system. And finally, I said, you know, we don't need to find new ways to finance the healthcare system. I mean, we do need to find optimal ways to finance this broken healthcare system. But let's stop talking about how to finance the broken system, and let's start talking about how to fix the broken healthcare system. That's why doctors were often feeling in the dark during a lot of these discussions. They had the frontline wisdom of the real problems, but feel as if nobody really asked their opinion. The piece today in the Wall Street Journal is about the so-called independent payment advisory boards, aka what Sarah Palin tweeted, Obama's death panel. Now, there's a lot of damage done by that tweet. We're trying to restore some of the truth about this. Do we believe that 535 members of Congress are in a good position to decide what Medicare should cover, given the millions and millions of dollars in corporate money that finances their campaigns, all the stuff that goes on, the ways of Washington? Or do we want an independent panel of doctors and medical experts that are not allowed to receive one penny from industry making decisions about what Medicare pays for? So the piece that I responded to was titled, Obamacare Panel Accountable to No One. It cited the 10-year-old girl that a few weeks ago was in the news because she was denied a lung transplant. Well, that had nothing to do with the Independent Payment Advisory Board. Matter of fact, it had nothing to do with Medicare. That's an organ shortage problem. It's part of the fear-mongering that I think has dominated a lot of the debate in healthcare. We need to stop talking about how to finance the broken system and start talking about how to fix the broken system. And that's why I wrote this book, Unaccountable. You know, if you look at some of the great doctors of our time, they are on board with this stuff, but they know that it's difficult to speak up about this problem. If you talk to really good doctors, they'll say, yeah, I've seen things in my career that could be fixed. It's just a difficult problem to fix. Now people are saying, let's fix this problem. The Institute of Medicine, one of the biggest bodies in American medicine as an authoritative group, the group that put out the study over 10 years ago that said that patients are dying from preventable medical mistakes. That's the most highly cited paper in the entire world medical literature. They put out they've put out many reports, but they put out another report last year. And you know what it said? I think this was more significant than the initial report that suggested that 100,000 people are dying a year from medical mistakes. This report said that up to 30% of everything we do in healthcare may not be necessary. 30% of expenditures may be going towards fraud. You may have heard of the recent fraud examples in Florida, where there are billing services that were never provided. Unnecessary tests, defensive medicine, unnecessary treatments, up to 30%. Now, if you look at the amount of potential savings, even if we addressed half of the waste in Medicare, it's a lot of money. That wipes out healthcare inflation. As a matter of fact, healthcare inflation has almost wiped out increases in wealth in the United States. The Milman Index, which is what health economists use to describe the true amount of money you spend on healthcare, that's your health insurance plus what you spend in co-pays and deductibles, plus what you spend in out-of-pocket, plus the percent of your U.S. dollar that's going in tax dollars for these programs. The Milman Index right now is $9,200 a year. Americans are getting crushed with these costs. I've got patients that complain to me about their co-pays. I've got patients that say their deductibles are basically so high, they only have catastrophic coverage. They're paying out of pocket for almost everything they do. Businesses are saying we can't compete with businesses overseas. If you have a business, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Business owners say, I spend money on contractors, and every contractor produces some result of performance. And I can use that to decide whether or not I want to hire them again, or whether or not I got a good value, or whether or not to appeal the service. Well, they say that's true for every contractor they have, except for one, healthcare. They say they're just throwing money at it, and they don't know what they're getting, and the bill goes up every single year. If you look at what we spend on healthcare, it's not the number that you're told. It's not the 20% number, because 20% of the federal healthcare expenditures go towards Medicare. Think about the interest on the debt. The interest on the debt is in part interest on the healthcare debt. Social Security, increasingly Social Security payments are going towards these co-pays and deductibles. And defense spending, do you know that 10% of the entire defense spending budget is on healthcare in the defense system? So we are spending closer to 31% of every dollar in the United States government on healthcare. And meanwhile, we've got this massive quality disparity that has been largely unaddressed. There's this new thing that we use to do surgery called the robot. Have you seen this robot? It's a gigantic, they call it Zeus for a reason. It looks like a giant spider, and it has these hands, and these hands move with more degrees of freedom than the human hand. We operate it from a sort of control, like a game control console. What they do is they strap the sensors to my fingers. And then in this chamber, I move my hands, and it mimics the movement of the robot hands. And I can do the surgery in the chamber, and it's happening inside the patient. Well, that sounds nice and everything, but at some point during the training, I said, what's the point? What are we doing? And they said, oh, it's really cool. And I said, I know it's cool, okay, but Arizona is rationing healthcare dollars. You can't get a liver transplant in Arizona because there's not enough money in the system. This thing costs $2.1 million in capital cost, $140,000 in a service contract every year, and $3,000 in disposable parts per operation on top of the regular operation costs. So yeah, I understand it's very cool. And I like it. I like the robot. It's fun. But at some point, we need to ask ourselves, what do patients need? And we got to be honest with patients. The data shows, all the research studies, this has been out 10 years. We don't need more research studies. We've got the research on this. Over 500 research articles on the robot. Only a small subset of operations has there ever been shown to be a benefit. Some of the operations, like hysterectomy, were reported in the Journal of the American Medical Association just a few months ago, have no difference in outcomes on a national level from laparoscopic hysterectomy. If you watched NBC's Rock Center, the new show with Brian Williams, they just did a segment on robotic surgery. It's on the internet, NBC Rock Center. They interviewed me for a piece of it where we talked about this story of the robot. In my opinion, it's a story of what's wrong with American healthcare. It's the massive adoption of an expensive technology with very little evaluation at a cost to those that don't have access to the system, those people in Arizona that can't get a heart transplant. You know, I do a procedure called a pancreas islet transplant. It's a crazy operation. Even I think it's one of the students told me, why do you do this? I said, because I'm crazy. We remove the human pancreas, put it in a laboratory during the operation, separate out the islets, which are the cells that make the insulin, and then we transplant those cells into the liver. And it's a great treatment for people that have chronic pancreatitis pain. Pancreatitis is so inflamed and causing so much pain over so many years that it can be a cure for these patients. Medicare likes this. They pay us very well. No, the money doesn't go to me. It goes to the hospital. But there's been historically a $20,000 bonus payment with each procedure. So you can imagine hospitals have gotten into the business. Well, they don't have the laboratory sometimes. So at some of the hospitals, including one famous hospital in New England, they fly the pancreas on a jet to another hospital, do the procedure in the laboratory, fly it back to the original hospital, do a second procedure on the patient to put it back in. This is just in my small area of surgery. I don't know cardiology that well. I don't know primary care very well. There's a lot of things in medicine that I'm not a specialist in, but this is my area. And I can tell you, this isn't my lack of understanding as when I was a medical student that made me question, think, this is wrong. And these are top hospitals. What on earth are they thinking doing two procedures, flying an organ on a jet when it could be done at any hospital electively? And what can we do about this problem? Well, I'm convinced the only reason a hospital can get away with this, or a surgeon can get away with this, is that the patients don't know their options. You think if they were told you could go to Baltimore and have this done in a one-stage procedure, that they would agree to have their organ flown on a jet to another? No. People are hungry for honesty in healthcare. And if we just increase the level of honesty through transparency from all levels, from bedside disclosure of mistakes to performance on a policy level nationwide, we could stop talking about different ways of financing healthcare differently and start talking about fixing healthcare differently. There's a guy named Desmond Doss. He wasn't afraid to speak up. This was a guy who, after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, he was a machinist, and he went to the local army recruitment station, and he said, I want to serve. And they signed him up, and he said, oh, by the way, one thing, I can't touch a gun. And they said, well, what? You're at an army recruitment station. What do you mean, I can't touch a gun? He said, "I when I was a kid, I think I was about 7 years old, and he witnessed an alcoholic uncle almost kill a family member with a gun. And when the police were coming, he buried the gun and he said a prayer and he said to God, I vow never to touch a gun for the rest of my life. He saw what a gun could do. Well, he told the army recruiter this and they didn't know what to do with him. Why are you signing up for the World War II? And you're saying, yeah. So they wrote on his card, they didn't know what to write, they wrote on his card, conscientious objector. Now, Desmond Doss was not afraid to speak up. He was a Boy Scout. He was good at tying knots, and he spoke up about his views on serving and basic training. He was the laughing stock of his basic training. But he went over to, in the Pacific on an island not far from Iwo Jima, and one night his battalion was cut off. The Army decided it was too risky to go and save the men, so they left him for dead. And that night, Desmond Doss lured about 100 men to their rescue using rope, all because he was not afraid to speak up. That's the kind of fresh ideas that we need in healthcare, people that are not afraid to speak up. Desmond Doss, to this day, is the only American ever to receive the Presidential Medal of Honor as a conscientious objector. That's someone not afraid to speak up. Sebastian Thune, making his engineering course at Stanford, which is very popular, open to anybody in the world through an online smart module. We're not talking one of these difficult to understand computer interfaces. We're talking about a smart web program that delivers the class to you. You take the exams, you do the homework, you get graded. 160,000 students signed up for his engineering class around the world. I didn't even know there was 160,000 people interested in engineering around the world. 41,000 finished the class. The top student at Stanford finished 411th. Smart people were taking this class. He's already talking about using his programs to decrease the cost of higher education by 90% over the next 10 years. That's someone who is not afraid to speak up. That's the fresh idea that we need in medicine. We need more transparency. You know, finally, I just want to end with the story of the most popular president ever to be elected in U.S. history. James Garfield. You may have had other ideas. James Garfield, by most historian standards, is considered to be the most popular president at the time of election. You see, he didn't want to be president. They begged him to do it. It was four presidents after Lincoln, if you saw the film. Now, Garfield had very progressive ideas for the country. He had spent a lot of time overseas. He spoke many languages. He was a professor. He was raised in poverty. He had many life experiences that made him connect with America. He believed women should have the right to vote. He believed blacks should have the right to vote. He was way ahead of his time. He appointed blacks to member of his administration immediately at a time when it wasn't really acceptable to do so. But because he was so popular, he could do these things. The destiny of the Republic was about to change, as Candace Millard writes in her book. But then 2 months into his presidency, somebody shot him at one of the railroad stations in Washington, D.C. The bullet sat underneath the skin in what we call the subcutaneous tissue. A fibrous capsule encapsulated the bullet. It caused no harm. It sat in the fat. He was taken back to the White House, and over the next 2.5 months, 8 different doctors probed his wound using dirty hands and dirty instruments. Now, Civil War doctors with good frontline medical experience had said, there's no need to dig out the bullet. They had seen this before. The bullets are hot. They're kind of sterile. You can leave the bullets in there. And digging it out is going to cause more harm than good. Well, Dr. Bliss, who was self-appointed himself the head doctor for the president, fired all the Civil War doctors, told the president he couldn't eat except for the one food he hated, which is oatmeal, and disclosed the facts of his condition to the press, but not to the family, as was classic in the Victorian-style medicine. Well, the president got a massive infection that went down to a psoas muscle on the opposite side. And the president later died of the infection. Now, the funny part of the story, by the way, as an aside, the assassin at his trial on the witness stand for assassinating the president of the United States said in his defense, and he was correct, "I just shot the president. The doctors are the ones that killed him." It turns out Lister from the UK had delivered his address 5 years prior to the doctors, explaining how sterile technique and antisepsis, washing your hands, using carboxylic acid, similar to the alcohol we use today to wash our hands, decreased death rates from 47% to 15%. But the doctors did not want to listen. And later they were asked and they said, after all, it's European data, so we know it's not that good. I want to thank you for listening and for taking the time to come, and I really enjoyed getting to know some of you, and I want to get to know more of you too afterwards. So thank you very much. Thank you, Linda. Thank you, Nancy. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. McCary. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions from the audience. And I have one to start us off with. Dr. McCary, what's the healthcare system going to look like in 10 years, especially from the consumer's point of view? And in particular, there's so much concern about cost escalation. At what point is it going to implode, and what's the solution that you envision?
So that's a great question. You know, many people often ask, at what point is this problem going to be so severe that it's actually going to result in a massive overhaul? I actually think the answer is very close. You know, this is one of these problems like the national debt. It's just been eroding at us for decades. And every now and then, some smart politicians will say, hey, wait a minute, this is a real problem. It's hard to be nonpartisan in D.C., but I see myself as an observer. I don't align myself with any political party. You see people every now and then make this a central issue, and I say, great. You know, these are the things we should be talking about all the time. If you talk to my patients, they are talking about their healthcare costs all the time. If you talk to people that have had an experience or interface with the healthcare system, most everybody has some story about some preventable aspect of care. So I think that for the first time ever, we're hearing policymakers talk about changing the fee-for-service system and paying hospitals and doctors based on performance and not based on volume. Right now, we've got doctors around the country that are getting fed up, burnt out, pissed off, that they're being held to monthly quotas on the number of operations they need to do, the number of patients they need to see. 60 Minutes just ran a report on hospitals that were pressuring their emergency room doctors to admit 50% of all patients over 65, regardless of whether or not they needed to be admitted. And these pressures are what's burning out American medicine. If we look at the hospitals that have the great culture, the hospitals like the Mayo Clinic, your hospital here in this community, from everything I've heard, these are the hospitals where it's a grassroots, good place culture. People are there with the same motives that they had when they interviewed for medical school, when they're in their brand new suits. They're there because they want to do good for society. So I think we're seeing, for the first time ever, to answer your question, seeing policymakers change the way that we create the incentives for doctors. I mean, let's face it, incentives work, and they can be perverse and do wrong things. And now we're recognizing, hey, we've got all this waste in healthcare that we could cut by changing the incentive to be quality-based, performance-based, and not volume-based. And that's the subject of a congressional hearing where I testified in front of Congress a few weeks ago on this very subject.
After transparency, showing variation with a high and low quality, how do we guide the system to use that information for learning and improvement rather than merely accountability and punishment?
That's a great question. And, you know, one thing I've really been keen to make a priority from the beginning of this effort to describe the transparency revolution in America through the book Unaccountable is to say we cannot alienate the one group of people that will save the healthcare system, and that is the doctors and the hospitals. They, with their patients, will change American healthcare. I mean, you may be frustrated with the healthcare system. Doctors are frustrated with the healthcare system. And when we listen to doctors, we get tremendous wisdom on how to make things better. You know, I travel to hospitals around the country almost every few weeks, and I hear doctors say, you know, I know how to make things better here in my unit. I know how to improve the heart surgery quality here in my department, but I don't feel that anyone's really asking me for my opinion. I don't feel that I have a say in how it gets done. And then you go to the other hospitals where they say, you know, every week we meet and talk about quality and safety in these new programs called CUSP and other small groups that bridge this leadership and frontline provider divide which has been created at some hospitals. That's why I think we're seeing a lot of the smaller non-university hospitals really crush it right now. They're doing very well because they have that close relationship with the CEO and the frontline people. You get to corporations the size of Lehman Brothers, it's very easy for a manager to detach, very easy. So we're learning. We're all learning together. And I think the more we can be honest about what's working and not working, the more we can fix this problem.
What about the issues of ethics in healthcare? How do we decide how much is too much? As you know, half of healthcare dollars are spent in the last year of a person's life, but we never know when is in the last year until it's over. But how do we decide how much to spend on treatments with uncertain or indefinite outcomes?
It's an impossible task, of course, but here's a simple solution that I've thought a lot about this. I've seen patients in the ICU for 3 months. They want to fight. They want to keep, you know, every possible chance at the 1%. Look, if they want to keep going, I'm with them. I've seen people go through that, and they don't want it. They're just going through it because there's no family around to, you know, make some choices for them. I've seen all extremes. What I'm convinced after thinking about this problem is that let's just start with the stuff that everybody agrees on. Let's start with patient empowerment. Let's start with allowing patients to make decisions for themselves, and you will overnight see a 10% reduction in healthcare utilization. Those are not my numbers. Those are numbers from the shared decision-making movement. If people really knew the risks and the complications of what they were about to go and the alternatives, including, hey, maybe we can wait a year and do this in 6 months or a year or when it causes more problems, you'd have a 10% instant reduction. That's why shared decision-making made it into the Affordable Care Act. Now, it was very broad, but they did say that they would support this shared decision-making movements. I mean, if patients really knew that their organ was going to be flown to another hospital and then flown back and they'd have two procedures instead of one, of course there'd be a reduction in healthcare waste. So I think patient empowerment. Otherwise, the subject of end-of-life care has been so demagogued that it's hard to have a rational conversation about it with a lot of folks.
A few years ago, my colonoscopy came due, but I had a $6,000 deductible on my health insurance. So I called around to compare my out-of-pocket costs at various local hospitals. No one was willing to give even a ballpark figure. The inability to make personal medical decisions based on cost-benefit analysis made me very angry. Please comment.
Okay. Is that a question for you or for me? Just kidding. No, this is a difficult problem everywhere in the country, right? No hospital can give you an estimate on a service. We're the only industry where you can't get a bid, you can't get an estimate, you don't know what you paid for after you got the service sometimes. And the reason is that, one, medicine is an art form and it's hard to predict. Two, they don't know what the bill is going to be until they put together have you seen this Time Magazine article called How Hospital Bills Are? Yeah, this is it. The charge master is actually sort of calculating what they need to bring in to compensate not only for your care, but for maybe the uncompensated care in other parts of the hospital. Our bills change every day, every single, same service. It's constantly being dialed up and down to maintain that profit margin. You know, hospitals, some of them are getting crushed right now. Some of them are closing their doors. So unfortunately, this fluid system has been one that has become the standard, and it's resulted in people not being able to get a bid on a service. Now, you actually can get a bid, but it's just not an official bid. You can find out the last patient that had a colonoscopy, how much did they end up paying for it? But I think we're seeing from that Time Magazine article this movement to say, hey, look, I want to be treated like a customer, like I would be treated in any other business. And I think once hospitals offer some of those bidding services, we're seeing it with OBGYN care now. I mean, the hospitals have to do it because with these high deductibles, you're paying out of your pocket. The tolerance for not having a bid for a standardized service is going to radically change. When you're not paying the bill, oh, it's going to cost $1,000? Okay, no, $10,000? Okay, whatever, I'm not paying. But when you're paying the bill, it's different. So we are seeing hospitals respond to this free market.
Here's an easy one. What is your opinion about Obamacare? Will it have a positive effect on unnecessary procedures?
So I think, you know, there's three major crises in American healthcare today. One is we are the wealthiest country in the world, and we have between 44 and 60 million people without access to the system. That's disgraceful for a country of our wealth. So the access problem is one crisis. Crisis number two, the cost crisis. Almost unrelated. We may figure out the coverage crisis, but the cost crisis, based on the trajectory from the last several years, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, it's still a major problem, and we still need more legislation to fix that. And number three is the quality problem, which I think is connected to the cost problem. And the reality is there is good and bad in the legislation. Even the authors from the Obama administration acknowledged that it wasn't the perfect solution, that more would need to be done, that it was one way to achieve coverage. And you know, the irony of it all is that the individual insurance mandate came from the Heritage Foundation. It was the Republican alternative to Hillary Clinton's plan years prior. So the irony is that the individual mandate, the most controversial piece of it, came from the Republicans. I think we need to say, look, there's good and bad in there. Let's work on the next steps to fix healthcare and stop talking about how we can overturn this giant piece of legislation.
Thank you, Dr. McCary, for sharing your time and expertise and giving us an inspiring lecture. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org. That's L-Y-C-E-U-M. Or by writing the Monadnock Lyceum Committee, 25 Main Street, Peterborough, New Hampshire, 03458. The program next Sunday will feature Gar Alperovitz, who will be speaking about, is there an America beyond capitalism? Dr. Alperovitz is the Lionel Bauman Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland and co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative.